This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're continuing our discussion with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin as we answer your questions. You can send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. You can also record a question for our weekly radio program that is broadcast live every Saturday from noon to 2 p.m. by going to drhoffman.com, go to our homepage, and there's a little black bar on the right-hand side. And if you click on that bar, it'll give you an opportunity to weigh in with a question or a comment. And if suitable, we'll read that question or comment on the air and answer it live. But the other option is send us an email, radioprogram@AOL.com. All right, Layla, what's our next question?
Okay, we've got an email from Larry. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, for years I've been trying to get to the bottom of why I suffer from fatigue. Guess what? I've just been diagnosed as having sleep apnea.
Wow.
While I'm not happy to hear the news.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm finally relieved to know what the problem is.
Yep.
What exactly is sleep apnea and how can it be treated? Is it a lifelong condition?
Mm-hmm.
I've met people with sleep apnea and they happen to be overweight, like me. Mm-hmm. Does being overweight contribute to this?
Well, yeah, let's talk about sleep apnea. First of all, this issue was tragically in the news recently when a New Jersey Transit engineer plowed into that station. I guess it was in Hoboken.
Yes.
And a woman died. Many people were injured. And he just came in at a full tilt speed, not applying the brakes. And, you know, initially they suspected mechanical failure or that he was drunk or, stoned or something. But it turns out that he had sleep apnea. And interestingly, he's suing New Jersey Transit for not properly screening him for sleep apnea. And, of course, in the wake of this tragedy, they are now doing very aggressive screening of all their personnel to make sure that they don't have sleep apnea, which results in extreme drowsiness. And it's responsible, actually, for a lot of automobile accidents. And I think the statistic that I read on the New Jersey Transit personnel is that 1 in 9 suffered from sleep apnea, which is just horrifying because your trained engineer or conductor may be suffering from a disease that impairs their judgment and wakefulness. It is associated with...
It's almost like being drunk when you're that tired.
Oh, yeah.
It's like being drunk to some degree.
Oh, absolutely. I've there are times when I was sleep deprived and I've been on the road and I just was a menace. You nod out and next thing you know, the car's and, drifting across one of the lanes. And it's just a really, really scary thing. So I also read of a case recently where a doctor was sued because they didn't properly diagnose a patient as having sleep apnea. They told the patient that they needed a lot of vitamins, that they needed this, that, and the other thing. But it turned out that the patient's fatigue was due to sleep apnea. And if the doctor had simply taken a proper history about sleep, which is important, taking a sleep history is important. The first question to ask is if you sleep with someone or if your sleep is observed, is do you snore? And if you snore, and if you wake up exhausted, and if you feel, like you're going to fall out at times during the day and you need naps, then a diagnosis of sleep apnea should be entertained, and you can go get a test called a polysomnography. Either go to a sleep lab, or now there are take-home tests that can be administered like Holter monitors are administered for heart disease, where you wear an apparatus at home, and it transmits the data to a center which can be analyzed. It also, on physical exam, you want to look for a fat neck. Man with a neck size 17 and a half or above, shirt collar size is at risk. Or people who are overweight or have insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, they're at risk. But the key question to ask is, do you wake up refreshed? And if you say, no, I yeah. feel like I've been run over by a truck and I'm exhausted on awakening, well, how many hours do you allow yourself to sleep? Oh, I'm in bed, you know, 8 hours. I get my 8 hours in bed, but you're exhausted? Okay, well, maybe you have sleep apnea.
Right. Wow. So, Larry, the cure for Larry could be some weight loss to see if that can fix the problem.
And often a low-carb diet.
You know, and that's really one of the best ways.
I think where you used to be when you initially were in this field, you were at the Atkins Center for a while. I think Atkins used to treat sleep apnea with the Atkins diet, you know, very low-carb diet. And it had dual advantages because it got people to lose weight, number one. And it also got rid of certain allergens because allergy yeah. may complicate it. You know, if you're like very congested, you're making a lot of mucus, you're going to have compromised airways. You know,
right. Yeah.
Yeah. It'll make you into a mouth breather because your nasal passages are chronically clogged.
Exactly. So, you know, when you have to breathe with your mouth during a bad cold, that's just awful.
Yeah, it's like
that's no sleep at all.
Yeah.
Imagine that's happening chronically to somebody. Oof.
Yep.
Yeah. Larry, thank you for your question.
Best of luck to you. Good news, because this is something that can be addressed. It can be addressed with CPAP, which a lot of people find uncomfortable, but better and better devices are being developed. Sometimes surgery, sometimes mouth appliances, but certainly nutrition's an important part of this. Weight loss is a key element of a strategy for treating sleep apnea.
Yeah, I hear reports of some people doing very well with sleep apnea and others they can't stand it because they find that it's noisy.
You mean with the CPAP device, yeah.
Right, the CPAP device, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, all right, Larry, thank you for your question. We've got an email from Trish. Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. I recently had blood work done and was told my DHEA is 48.
Mm-hmm.
This seems very low to me, and I'm wondering if this is why I'm tired a lot. I was thinking of taking 50 milligrams of DHEA a day. Is this a good idea?
It's a woman or
a
man?
59. Okay. Yeah, woman.
Woman.
This is a woman, Trish.
Yeah. Right.
She's 59 years old, and she says, I read that I should not take the supplement unless under a doctor's supervision.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure why, since you could buy it over the counter.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It's like,
yeah.
This supplement could be dangerous, so make sure you're under doctor supervision. And, oh, by the way, you can buy as much as you want. Fill up your shopping cart and, you know, sell it on the school playground.
Right.
You know, it's like,
well, bottom line, it's a hormone.
It is a hormone, yeah.
And it's the substrate where other hormones are made.
It's the mother hormone.
It's the mother hormone.
Yeah.
Right.
It's the mother of all hormones. Okay, so here's the deal. When you check for DHEA, there are two tests. There's a DHEA test and there's a DHEA sulfate test. And I'm not sure which of these tests this woman has undergone.
Doesn't specify.
If it is the DHEA sulfate test, which is the correct test, a level of 48 is a little bit low for a woman of 59. And she might enjoy some benefits from taking DHEA. I like to see DHEA in the range of about 100, 125 maybe for a woman of that age. For men, maybe, you know, 200 to 300. In that age, because men generally have more DHEA than women. Taking 50 is too much, in my opinion, for a woman.
Yeah.
I rarely prescribe it. I mean, I prescribe 50 sometimes in conditions of autoimmunity like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, something like that. But DHEA is proven to be helpful in lupus, by the way. It's anti-inflammatory. Yeah. You know, you might get some side effects if you take 50 as a woman. You might get oily skin or even acne, or you might get a little hair recession. And, you know, the reason that it's said to be there's a caution on it is that if you have breast cancer or if you have prostate cancer, maybe it's not such a good idea to up your hormone levels.
Right.
And so
– more estrogen from the DHEA.
Yeah. It can be a little estrogenic. It can also be a little androgenic. Both,
yeah.
You know, and it varies from individual to individual. I notice that some men who have low testosterone and low DHEA, we give them DHEA and their testosterone comes up. And some men, their DHEA goes up, but their testosterone doesn't go up. So
which brings us to actually Trisha's second question.
Yep.
Actually, she says, also my testosterone is 0.3.
That's low.
Which I'm sure doesn't help my energy levels. I'm not sure how to fix that.
Right. And a good way to address that is to take a little DHEA. It might boost the testosterone.
Yeah.
Alternatively, you know, go on a more comprehensive hormone replacement therapy. I don't like to just give women testosterone alone.
Right.
I can give DHEA alone, but if I'm going to give testosterone to a woman, I want to give her a little estrogen, progesterone with testosterone. And that is a more balanced hormone replacement therapy that
yeah.
Can really sometimes help lift women of that age out of the doldrums.
I would investigate with Trish her diet, her use of alcohol, which can tank testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
If she's at least a recreational marijuana user, that will tank testosterone.
Right.
And if she's not getting enough strength training exercises, we know mm-hmm. that if you do squats
yep.
regularly,
yep.
that can help boost testosterone.
Yep.
All of that, as well as DHEA.
Mm-hmm.
Benefits of proper diet, good sleep, minimal alcohol, if not completely eliminating it, and all of that, strength training exercise.
This morning I was up to, I was proud of myself, I was up to 95-pound squats. But that's
wow.
really, but that's, it sounds like a lot, but it's really ridiculous because true, really good strength-trained people can easily squat their body weight and way beyond, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And on an incline where, you know, this incline press where your back is supported, it's not uncommon to see even women do 200-300 or more pounds. Women are
right.
very powerful in those muscles. They really
mm-hmm.
have a relative – that's one area in which women can compete pretty successfully with men.
Yeah, the biggest muscle groups.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Torch metabolism. They torch calories.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's a really good,
they keep
good thing.
From becoming feeble. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And and associated with balance, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can take all the Fosamax in the world, but, you know, if you have weak pelvic girdle and, you know, weak
yes.
leg muscles, you're going to more easily stumble and fall. You won't have stability.
Right. Right. And I do want to say, because Trisha's 59, that DHEA is important for bone health.
Yep.
So if there's any osteopenia, osteoporosis, you may benefit from a smaller dose of DHEA, but again, with supervision. That's
I would start with a 10 for a
mm-hmm.
while, and I would keep measuring the DHEA. But it sounds like, you know, she is a doctor is measuring her DHEA. That doctor should supervise it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Trish, thank you for your question. We've got an email from Bart. Hello, Dr. Hoffman. What are your thoughts on healthy men in their 60s taking saw palmetto for prostate health?
I am one of them. You know, and I'm not taking it because, uh-huh. I mean, I actually think saw palmetto is more beneficial as a preventive than for reversal of enlarged prostate. I think it's a
yeah.
rather weak blocker of BPH.
Mm-hmm.
Which is benign prostatic hypertrophy. If you have a very enlarged prostate, my experience is that saw palmetto doesn't work very well. But I do take it to prevent the age-related enlargement of prostate that's likely to occur. I've been taking it for 25 years. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard you say over the years that the time to start taking saw palmetto for men is in their 30s.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Terrific. It can also keep the hair on your head.
Yeah.
Bart.
Right. Well, so, I'm not right. sure if, I'm not sure if that accounts for the fact that I've got a luxuriant head of hair. But
right.
You know, I don't want to do the alternative
uh-huh.
experiment. See.
Okay. So, all right. Well, what other things could Bart take then? You know, if he's interested in prevention, besides saw palmetto, maybe
prevention of enlarged prostate, prevention of an enlarged prostate,
or just for He's a prevention of prostate cancer. He's a healthy man in his 60s.
Okay, well, let's talk.
Wanting to protect his prostate, yeah.
Well, let's go through them. You know, I actually wrote an article to that effect, so, you know, around a year ago.
Yeah.
And you can reference that at drhoffman.com. It lists the supplements for prostate cancer prevention and even treatment, you know, once you have prostate cancer. Vitamin D, of course, mm-hmm. and vitamin D seems to help the prostate. Also, flaxseed. We use a product called, let's see, what's it called?
Are you talking about Pectisalt? No.
No, flaxseed.
I was thinking pumpkin seed oil.
Pumpkin seed oil. Yeah, but the flaxseed lignans are helpful.
Prevail.
Right, Prevail. Mm-hmm. And the male product is called Provail, but I think we just use Prevail for both sexes.
Right.
Because it is protective against hormonal cancers. We like to use the right kind of vitamin E, the right kind of selenium, which would be mixed tocopherol vitamin E. And,
right. And methylselenocysteine.
Right, which is not...
For selenium.
Mm-hmm. Which is a little unusual type of selenium. And then green tea, EGCG, curcumin.
EGCG.
Yep.
Right. Probably the biggest chemotherapeutic agent on the planet for cancer.
Do you know that there was just a study that just came out on EGCG showing that it could lower LDL by, on average, about 5 points and overall cholesterol
wow.
by 2 points? Just taking, I think it was 4 capsules a day of EGCG.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Wonderful. Bart, eat a very clean diet, remain healthy, get regular exercise, all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Bart, thank you for your question. Oh, we've got a really interesting one here. Okay, this email comes from Mira. My dad recently had hip replacement and went psychotic for 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
We've tested his 23andMe previously, and he has one copy of the MTHFR C677T.
That doesn't mean anything, in my opinion.
That's a very
common variant. It could affect as many as, you know, half of people of Northern European ancestry. So
yeah.
But if a double hit on that might be more consequential. But that's not where to look. It's,
yeah.
you know.
He has since recovered.
Sure.
He has since recovered, but he's fully functioning now. Mira's wondering, do you have any ideas?
Yeah, no, I definitely have. It's a well-known phenomenon. It's called ICU psychosis or hospital psychosis. It's a very well-known entity, and it comes from a variety of things. First of all, you know, you have pain, you're debilitated. You're in a hospital where you're completely stripped of many familiar cues. It's always light. There's no day-night circadian rhythm. You're on drugs, which will impair your mentation. And then you get anesthesia. And then kablooey, you know, you just go nutso. And I saw it all the time during my training in mainstream hospitals, and it's a well-known entity, ICU psychosis. And then, you know, you get a psychiatric consult, and it usually abates when people are taken out of those circumstances. Now, it is predictive of risk for mental disorders or risk of Alzheimer's later on. It may be that people who are already a little bit, shall we say, less mentally anchored are more prone to this. You know, if they're having early onset dementia, that they may, that may just put them over the edge. And in ordinary circumstances, they're less liable to express the potential to go there.
Wow. I've never heard of this. This is news to me
as
well. That's wild.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I broke my hip. I was in the hospital. I didn't experience psychosis, but, you know, I certainly went through, you know, emotional ups and downs with the medication, with the pain, with the anemia associated with that.
And low magnesium.
And I had, in a famous story, I told the resident, you know, just upon entering, I said, give me an infusion of magnesium. And the guy said, we can't unless we test you. And they finally got around to testing me about three days into it, and they found I was very low in magnesium. And I said, I told you so. You should have given it to me on, you know, why don't they give it to people preventively? And they said, that's very interesting. Maybe we should do a research paper on it. And that's the last I heard about it.
Right, right. Oh, my. Okay. Mira, we're glad your father is better. Hang in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the good thing, too, is, I mean, hopefully he wasn't administered all kinds of heavy-duty antipsychotic drugs, because that'll just make recovery harder. Is there such a thing as a quick question or a quick comment?
Let's see. I've got an email from John. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, can you speak for a moment about blood viscosity as it pertains to sticky or fatty blood? Can this be part of the problem that causes plaque buildup in the arteries? And could regular blood donation be a natural way to reduce blood viscosity?
Okay. Well, viscosity means kind of like, you know, one analogy is your motor oil, you know, and like you use a certain type of motor oil in the winter that's lighter than in the summer because at cold temperatures it gets thicker and it'll gum up your engine. So in the summer you use a heavier weight motor oil because the high temperatures will thin the oil and allow your engine to function. Okay, that's the idea of viscosity. There's a lot of influences on blood viscosity or flow. One of them is the blood count. So if you have a condition called polycythemia, which is like a very, very high blood count, maybe you have instead of a count of 45, a count of 60 hematocrit, you might have your blood may be thicker and more viscous. But there are a lot of things that go into whether you're going to have blood flow problems. You know, one of them is if your blood clots easily, and that has to do with platelets, and that can you actually can measure PT and PTT, which tell you about that. The ultimate test is not done very often is a bleeding time. You know, you actually do an experimental cut and you see how long it takes for the blood to stop flowing from like a small self-administered cut. So I mean, it is. I think we're probably barking up the wrong tree by giving blood to thin the blood to make you're less likely to have a stroke or a heart attack.
Right. Because it's just you'll have less blood, but it doesn't necessarily thin it.
Right.
Well,
it does get rid of excess bodily stores of iron, which may act as a prooxidant, which can damage arterial walls. I guess can contribute to cardiovascular disease, but there's a whole subsection of hematology that deals with problems related to blood clotting, and many a boring lecture in medical school about these very complex pathways, multiple pathways that are associated with the risk of bleeding, and also many of the drugs that are used to prevent blood clots, they work on different pathways. You know, aspirin, Plavix. Now we have, of course, we have old fashioned Coumadin, but we have newer drugs.
Eliquis,
yeah.
Pradaxa.
Pradaxa, uh huh. And they all work on slightly different pathways.
Hmm. Wow. Okay, John. So blood donation isn't necessarily the answer.
No. Bottom line.
Okay.
All right.
But thank you for your question.
Good question. Thank you. Layla, that's all the time, unfortunately, we have for today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Time flies when you're having fun.
Okay.
And we're getting up to holiday season, so I want to wish our many listeners very happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Mm-hmm. And for some of our listeners, Hanukkah coincides with Christmas this year. A little unusual because usually usually Hanukkah comes a little earlier, but this year, because of that lunar calendar relatively coincides. So many of our listeners get in the holiday swing of things. We'll keep broadcasting and we'll provide you with some fresh materials, especially if you have a little downtime during the holidays, you can catch up. And I'll be providing a compendium of some of our top 10 podcasts of 2016. And these are mostly podcasts, Layla, with guests. Of course, all our
terrific
Intelligent Medicine Q&A with Layla podcasts are excellent and worthy of listening. But if you want to listen to distinguished guests and experts in the field of natural medicine, just check out my list of the top 10 podcasts and download them and enjoy them over the holiday season.
Happy holidays to all.
Indeed. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.